Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
You say I'm a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hello, I'm Todd Stiefel. Welcome to the Humanist Hour podcast, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
And I'm Jess Constantine. Humanism is the life stance that we can be good and ethical without a belief in God or the supernatural. So Todd, the summer is almost halfway over. What have you been up to?
Traveling. I got to go to Hawaii. That was pretty sweet.
You did, and you didn't see a need to bring your co-host with you?
I did not see a need to bring this co-host with me. I brought my other co-host, the one who co-hosts my home.
Your co-host of life?
My life host. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I brought Diana and the kids, and we met up with some good friends of ours out there, and we just had a blast. It was awesome.
Well, hey, while you've been taking the summer off, some Christians down in Texas are planning something really big.
Yes. Rick Perry and his group of fundamentalist friends are organizing a prayer rally in Houston on August 6th, which I'm sure all of our listeners will be attending, clearly.
Yep.
So what do you think about this little event, Jess?
I was just looking at the website, and it's a response to our nation being in a state of crisis, you know, economically, and didn't actually mention any sort of environmental crisis, though, did it, on the website, which is interesting to me.
He says natural disasters, but not environmental problems, because that wouldn't jive well with his conservative stances on most politics.
Right. So I guess the big hype about this is that the Texas Governor Rick Perry is very much involved in the organization, planning, promotion, et cetera, of this event. And so I guess the question is, whose dime is he doing it on? Or is he doing it outside of his role as Texas governor? What do you think?
It's kind of unclear right now. I mean, he's definitely relying on his identity as governor of Texas. He's signing things, Rick Perry governor. But I'm actually okay with that piece. The challenge is that he's trying very hard to get the president and all 49 other governors to show up for this and make this basically a big government rally around one particular type of Christianity. And so that's where this starts getting really muddled. I mean, if he is as an individual is doing this, that's one thing. But if he's doing it as governor and or trying to make it an official government event, then we're not just talking like stepping on the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. We're talking about like completely trampling on it. I mean, that's like literally trying to establish fundamentalism as as something that the government promotes and sponsors and rallies people to come pray before.
Right. Because, you know, the event says it's both apolitical, non-denominational, and Christian.
Because Christianity is not a denomination of religion.
Yeah. I mean, they're clearly, you know, praying for Jesus to come and help them.
Absolutely.
In God's name. So, I know tons of religious people who wouldn't stand for that, who wouldn't want to pray for that. So, I'm a little confused.
Yeah, well, this is also co-sponsored by the American Family Association, which, by the way, has been labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center because of their massive anti-LGBT and Muslim stances. And the website for the response is crystal clear. I mean, this is for people with a belief in the Trinity, the belief that the Bible is infallible, the belief in the resurrection, etc. This is, I mean, when you start getting into the Bible is infallible, this means you believe in Jonah getting swallowed by a big fish and surviving for several days and, you know, Noah's Ark and all that fun stuff. I mean, this is really pure fundamentalist dogma here that they're trying to spread. What else is interesting is all over this website, which is theresponseusa.com, is references to the book of Joel, chapter 2. And I found at least four or five references to this same book of the Bible on there. And it's saying, he comes right out and says, some problems are, this is a quote from Governor Perry, some problems are beyond our power to solve. And according to the Book of Joel, chapter 2, this historic hour demands a historic response. Therefore, on August 6th, thousands will gather to pray for a historic breakthrough for our country and renewed sense of moral purpose. And he goes on to say that we need to beg for forgiveness and wisdom, etc. So I pulled up Joel 2, and it's scary, like really scary. This book starts with talking about an army of locusts that the Lord sends upon his people. So, which says, and I quote, it is close at hand, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness. Like dawn spreading across the mountains, a large and mighty army comes, such as never was in ancient times, nor ever will be in ages to come. And then it talks about fires and flames blazing and things being burned and desert being left behind and cavalry and chariots and battles and wars. And then comes the Lord saying, you know, but hey, if the next part, which are the quotes they're using of Joel 2, or all these parts about, you know, now fast and weep and mourn before me. And if you do, then you'll be forgiven. And I won't send my army upon you. And then the story ends with the people giving in and fasting and weeping and crying and throwing themselves before his terror.
Right.
And then he says, you know, oh, okay. Now he takes pity on them and he says that he'll send them grain and wine and all these things. And so then the Lord finally says, In Joel 2:25, I will repay you for the years the locusts have eaten, the great locusts and the young locust, the other locusts and the locust swarm, my great army that I sent among you. I mean, how twisted is that?
I mean, it's certainly not something that I would read to my children before bed. I mean, yeah, that's dark. So I would love to know how our listeners feel about the governor of Texas being so heavily involved, officially or non-officially, that's not yet clear. But the Freedom From Religion Foundation has sued the Texas governor over planning this prayer rally. So they filed a lawsuit seeking that a declaration that Texas Governor Rick Perry's initiation, organization, promotion, and participation as governor in a prayer rally at Reliance Stadium in Houston, Texas, scheduled for August 6th, in collaboration with the American Family Association, violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
See, I think this is an interesting lawsuit, and I'm no lawyer, but I'm really worried they're going to lose that suit and set bad precedent and make things harder on us in situations like this. Mostly because from what I've read about it in FFRF announcements that they've sent out via email is they're basically trying to stop him from taking part in this event at all. And, you know, it would be probably wiser to sue to have him, you know, disassociate the state of Texas from it, not right. use the state seal. And that's one of the things they're asking. They're saying he shouldn't be allowed to use the state seal. Totally agree. The state seal should not be on the event.
Right.
But, you know, my thought is, say, he can go as an individual, but stop him from going and trying to represent the state of Texas in a revival.
Right.
That's fair, but it seems like they might be overextending themselves a bit, which could get the whole case tossed and just, you know, empower the religious right even further.
Interesting. So this month for our listeners, we have an interview with actually a guest who was on our show briefly last month, and that is writer, director, and producer Matthew Chapman. Matthew was born in England, and he's the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. He talks about his reasons for leaving school at the early age of 15 in his book, Trials of the Monkey, an accidental memoir. Since living in the States, he's written and directed 3 films, produced 4, and written or co-written countless scripts for both studios and independents, several of which have been produced.
Yeah, we got really lucky being able to talk to him twice because we got the opportunity to talk to him briefly before the movie came out.
Yeah, last month was kind of he wanted to sort of rally the atheist and humanist movement to sort of get behind the ledge like the Christians did for
Passion of the Christ.
Exactly. So that was sort of the purpose behind having him on our show last month, to get the word out about the movie, to get listeners to download and watch the movie, so that it would release more widely in theaters. So we're going to hear how it all worked out for Matthew. But before we get to his interview, here's a clip from his movie, The Ledge.
What did God do to you to make you so angry at him? Look at the world that he created. All the beauty, you know, wars and plagues and genocides and earthquakes and tidal waves. And then, after all that suffering, what does your God do next? He sends most of us to hell.
Well, not if you've been born again.
Right, the old baptismal jacuzzi.
You have to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. That is your only entrance requirement.
Okay, so the Hebes, the Hindus, the Muslims, the atheists, the Buddhists, all damned, right?
They have to accept Jesus Christ.
And the Catholics, because they're not born again, right?
Right.
And face it, man, it's kind of crazy.
No, it's not crazy. God gives us free will for that purpose. Otherwise, we would just be puppets. Life would be meaningless. That's the beauty of eternal salvation. You see, anyone can go to heaven or hell, because anyone can be saved. It's your choice.
Unless you're a kid in China who gets hit by a bus and never even heard of this getting saved deal. Where's his choice?
Well, that's why it's so important to spread the gospel. Try and save people.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh. I just find this kind of fundamentalism incredible. I mean, all of you, totally convinced you know exactly who God is and exactly how he wants to be worshipped. And all without a lick of evidence he even exists. No wonder there's so many holy wars. Without evidence, how else would you win this argument except by killing each other?
See, I see evidence in all kinds of things.
So do they. And sooner or later, one of these guys who hears God in his head is going to get a hold of weapons of mass destruction. And then when it's way too late, we're finally going to ask ourselves why, after thousands of years of bloodshed, didn't we at least try to do away with this insane concept of faith before it killed us?
You know, maybe I'm just coming at this from a different angle.
And what angle would that be?
Okay, listeners, we're here with Matthew Chapman, who is the writer and director for the movie The Ledge. Matthew, you were on our show last month where we gave our listeners sort of a little sneak preview about your movie, The Ledge. And now that it's been out for about a month online and it went out into theaters, let's talk about how the movie did during its release.
Well, I mean, it did very well on a certain level and is continuing to do very well. It's doing very well on video on demand and very well on streaming. You know, you can get it on iTunes and so on. And it did very well. I think you could say it did very well in the atheist community and on in that method of, you know, within that method of delivery. So I had a lot of wonderful reviews. I've had people calling me and saying how much they like it and emailing me. But what I had really hoped I could do was get enough people to see it in its theatrical release that it would become a phenomenon in the way that Passion of the Christ was. And although there were groups that supported it in Los Angeles and in New York, it wasn't enough to get that effect.
Well, Matthew, that's certainly been one of the questions that we've been sort of asking on this show. You know, as someone who works for an activist nonprofit, whose target base, whose target audience is sort of by nature a group of individuals who don't necessarily want to belong to a group. They don't want to get involved. So our question is, what kinds of things can we provide to form community around? And one of the answers that we've come up with is certainly the arts, and certainly things like music and art and film. And so I think that you've certainly put forth a valiant effort.
Maybe if I'd made something more, you know, if there was an atheist figure who was like Christ, who was just sort of, no, but, you know, from their perspective, they look at Christ and they just see a wholly good, fantastic superhero.
Right.
My atheist was certainly not a superhero. And maybe if there was such a character in history, Mithu was a sort of an atheist Gandhi, for example, then perhaps it would have been possible to have brought them out in that way.
So do you think that that would hurt you in the theaters? Because as you were saying, it's done extremely well online. But you think what hurt you in the theaters was the flaws of the character?
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting to listen to people's... I wouldn't say it was the flaws of the characters. I'm just saying that it wasn't a movie in the way that Passion of the Christ was a celebration of a superhero. Mine wasn't that. And there was plenty of room for criticism. The criticisms that I got were from the atheist community was, well... did he have to sleep with someone else's wife, or did she have to be so passive? And there's a point at which art and propaganda have to be separate things, because if one becomes too much the other, it fails to be either. And so I sort of made the decision that, in the end I had to go with art, but clearly if you look at the movie, my heart is behind atheism, and I think that's a value. And I think the film will continue to do well on video on demand and streaming. So it's all fine. It's all good.
It's interesting how, because certain films get a cult following later on, and they may not do fantastically in the theater, but they do well online. They get a wide release, and next thing you know, everybody's picking them up on Netflix, and they end up kind of getting a life of their own.
Yeah, and I think that will happen. And I think, I showed it to my stepson, and he said this film will go on forever and ever. And he's a fellow atheist, but he lives in Australia. He said it'll go on forever and ever because there's nothing else like this. You can't, if you want to rent an atheist film, there's nothing better than this, particularly if you're young, because they identify with Charlie Hunnam. So I think it will have a long, long, long life. And, it does change people's minds. I think I may have told you last time I was on that I've had emails from people who were sort of on the fence and who became, committed atheists and felt they had the arguments to sort of come out because of the film. And emails from Christians who, having watched it, decided to reconcile with gay relatives or be more friendly to people of other faiths. You know, it has a definite emotional effect on people.
That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw the movie and enjoyed it. And one of the things I thought was truly a mark of a great movie is that I was thinking about it more than an hour afterwards. I kept going back to it in my mind and rerunning pieces of it and kind of analyzing it. And so it left a lasting impression on me. And I think that, at least from my perspective as a viewer, I really am happy with the way you treated the characters. I mean, if I don't watch a movie to see idealizations of people. At that point, they're not really characters. They're caricatures. And so the fact that your characters had flaws as people and strengths is really what makes them people. I thought it actually helped bring them out. I think that if you had made the lead character an atheist, but also a perfect moral person, I think it would have really taken away, not just from the art of the movie, but I think it would have taken away from the message too, because it would have been so unrealistic as to pull people out of the movie.
Well, exactly. I mean, what is it to be a humanist? It's to understand that human beings have flaws and that they are human and that we should forgive them and give them love and cherish them in spite of their flaws. I think that's the essence of what makes humanists better people.
Absolutely.
And it's the expectation of people being perfect that makes religion do so many evil things.
I was also happy with how you handled that storyline. Coming from the perspective of someone who used to work with victims of domestic violence, and it's nice that that Liv's character was in a place I mean, she was in an unhealthy relationship, but then she made the choice to act and to change and to move toward a healthy relationship. I'm not saying that even if you're in an unhealthy relationship, it's okay to commit adultery. But I think that it's good that she felt she empowered herself to make a choice to be in a healthy relationship based on the right characteristics that he was giving her as a partner. In particular, I love that scene where he's telling her that she doesn't need anyone to take care of her because she can take care of herself. Like, to me, that's a powerful way to show someone that you love them.
Well, how nice to hear that from a woman. Because some women have sort of said, oh, how can Shayna be so passive? But I mean, she's beaten into passivity, and that's the whole point.
Well, and unfortunately, oftentimes in situations like this, the person who ends up getting blamed is the victim.
Very interesting point.
She does eventually seize control in many ways, so she's not completely passive.
No. I think that, in fact, I've had women come up to me who have been in abusive relationships and relationships, you know, with people like Joe, who are actually sort of religiously kind of menacing. And they have been very inspired by Liv and have said, wow, that's kind of amazing. It was so moving to see the way she eventually walked away from that character. And it's very gratifying when you hear something like that from, you know, from people who have actually suffered. That makes the whole thing completely worthwhile and beautiful.
The performance I thought was most impressive was Terrence Howard's. I thought he did a phenomenal job, and was just curious what you thought about that and his character.
I really admire the journey that that character goes on. I mean, he starts off with this horrible piece of news that is an attack, if you like, on his manhood and on what he thinks marriage is and who his wife is. And through going through his encounter with this atheist, he comes to see at the end that there's no better virtue than forgiveness, if you like, for a human weakness, and the continuing love that you can have for your family in spite of the vicissitudes of life. And the character of Terrence is actually based on my father, who discovered that my mother had had an affair and given birth to a baby that he thought he was his, and then raised that child completely as one of us. There were four of us, and this boy was 5 years younger than me and not my full brother. And I always thought there was something heroic in that, and that's the kind of heroism that I admire, and it's the kind of heroism that I think we all see kind of frequently in life. I mean, this is one of the bits of bullshit about religion is that people are not heroic except with God. And I think you see people all the time going through very difficult situations and being completely heroic in the sense of devoting their lives to other people and people who are having even worse hardships. And it's because they have a sort of human love. It's nothing to do with God. And that's certainly true of my father. He didn't want to break the family up. He didn't want to hurt the rest of us kids. So he kind of, you know, he took it.
Wow, that's admirable.
So I noticed something right at the beginning of the film while the pre-credits were going and wanted to ask you about it. I noticed that and I may pronounce this wrong, but Prince Faisal S. Al Saud was an executive producer, and I believe he is a member of the royal family of Saudi Arabia. I thought it was very interesting that a Saudi prince would be a financier of a movie with such a strong atheistic message.
Yeah, well, that's really just one of the kind of weird things that happen in independent filmmaking. There were 23 producers on the film, and I only met four of them. Two of them were kind of helpful, and the rest were either not there or a pain in the ass. And Prince Faisal, I never met. I think he gave some sort of bridging loan or something. I don't think he knew what the movie was about. And I have no idea. I was always curious about that myself, about what would happen to him when this opened in the Middle East, which it's going to do. It's been sold to the Middle East and will eventually come out there, which will be fascinating.
That could create an interesting media story as well, because there could be some huge criticism of him in that community for supporting such a film.
Yeah, well, I said to the other producer who was actually involved in the whole thing, don't you think you ought to show this to him before he puts his name on it? And they said, well, someone who works for him has read the script, they know what it's about, and I hope I still have my head on my shoulders next time.
I hope he does too.
Exactly. I don't have to go there. He may at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Matthew, this film obviously is connected to people's personal beliefs, and I was just wondering if you could give our listeners sort of a behind-the-scenes idea about, like, you know, did all the actors ever sort of come together and debate? Did they agree with the characters that they played and things like that?
Well, I was kind of very careful about that, because I thought if I dig too deeply into their own personal beliefs and they turn out to have some kind of absurd faith that I can't handle, I'm getting to get into an argument with them, and it's not going to help the character. So I didn't really find out. I know Terrence has some sort of, or has or has had at some point, some sort of religious background, unsurprisingly for an African-American, because that community is so connected to the church. Liv, I would suspect, is sort of mildly into some sort of, oh, I think there's something out there kind of a thing. I think Charlie probably the same. Patrick plays his cards pretty close to his vest, but he certainly inhabited that character of the fundamentalist with such relish that I suspect he doesn't believe much, otherwise he would have had a problem with it. such a good actor, that guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think this is a movie that pretty much all atheists and humanists, if they're into film, should check out. I think the vast majority will love it. And those who don't, I think at the very least will find it very, very interesting. And from the reviews I've read online, it seems like there's a huge split between anybody who's even remotely fundamentalist despises it, of course.
Right.
The critics seem to have a beef with it, but just about all humanists and atheists seem to absolutely love this movie.
Well, that was the other kind of thing for which I was not prepared. And I don't know why I wasn't, because it would make perfect sense. But for example, I have definite evidence that Christians have gone online and given the movie bad sort of points on these websites like IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, and Metacritic, where you can go on and vote for the movie. They've gone on and just sort of, without even seeing the movie, voted badly to bring the rating down. I didn't expect that, and I know it happened because I saw some exchanges on a website, but I didn't expect that because I sort of don't think about people being fundamentally dishonest. But it doesn't matter that well. In terms of the critics from the mainstream papers, there was one review in the New York Times that was very scathing of the film. And when I looked up this guy's other reviews, I found certain sort of references to things that clearly showed that he's a believer of some kind. And I think I sort of underestimated the way in which people would be offended by it, because, I mean, the lead character doesn't just attack Christianity, he attacks the whole concept of faith. And I didn't sort of think about the way in which someone who would be offended religiously would then review the film. And I think that what's happened a couple of times is people have been offended by the anti-religious humanist message in the film. And then rather than just sort of come out and say, well, I think this is philosophically absurd, I disagree with it, they've attacked Liv Tyler's acting, or the cinematographer's cinematography, or my direction or writing, without making reference to what's really underlying the animosity. And I'm sure, of course, there are some people who just don't like it and they have a perfect right to. But
I think it's a valid point, because these critiques are very subjective, and being subjective, they are heavily influenced by bias. So if somebody goes in to the movie and is quickly offended, uncomfortable, and even angry because it is in conflict with their personal beliefs, there's a much greater likelihood that they're going to be feeling negative emotions, and then they're going to associate those negative emotions with the movie itself. And so they may be looking for flaws rather than looking for things that make them happy. And I think that I suspect that bias goes both ways, where atheists may be overly positive because they're looking for the things they love and are finding those things and maybe overlooking faults.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And, you know, time will tell, A, how good of a movie it is, and B, how much influence it has on people, young and old, Christian and atheist, in terms of the way they think. And I think it's a, you know, I mean, there's a sort of a rule in this country, which sort of doesn't really apply so much in Europe, where, you know, you don't sort of talk about politics and religion. And so people are unaccustomed to a film like this that is such a, is so sort of openly argumentative on both sides. And I think people do get kind of pissed off. And I think you're more likely to get pissed off as a believer than as a non-believer, because as a non-believer, you're kind of going, wow, I haven't heard this viewpoint that's mine expressed in a movie before. And so you're kind of pleased by it. Yeah. And the other thing that I find very, very strange and fascinating is the kind of Bill Donahue response. You know, I had Bill Donahue attack the film from the Catholic.
That's an honor.
No.
You should get a plaque that comes with that one.
Send it over. Yeah. No, I'd happily take that. It would be sort of an upside down cross. This sort of thing that these guys have about, and not just him, but a lot of Christians, of, oh, we're the victims and how Hollywood is always attacking us. And of course, we're used to getting bashed up and all the rest of it. But I mean, this country is, what is it, 60% Christian or something, and 94% faith-based in its attitudes. Where do they get the idea that they're victims? I mean, we're the victims. We're the 4% who, you know, can't get elected.
I think it's an interesting strategy they're using. I think it's completely intentional. I think they know deep down, at least the leaders do, that they're not really the victims, that they are either the majority, or they can give, I think more appropriately is that they can give the impression that they're the majority. Because oftentimes people like Bill Donahue and Rick Warren and these folks, they're actually representing a very small minority of the population that are fundamentalists, religionists. But because the majority of the population by a wide margin is religious, they then attempt to speak for all of them. And they play this victim card as a strategy to defend their beliefs. I think it's sad, but it's something that we see over and over again in our movement.
I agree, Todd. And Matthew, I was just wondering if we were going to see sort of a public debate between you and Bill Donahue.
Sadly, he hasn't responded yet. I wish he would. I would love to do that. I think, going to do a debate with Bloomberg Television and some NPR stations called "The World Would Be a Better Place Without Religion." Yeah, and it's in something they do called Intelligence Squared. I've been invited to participate in that. And it's me and A.C. Grayling, I believe.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, versus two unnamed as yet people of faith.
Oh, I wonder if one of them will be Kirk Cameron from that show Growing Pains, who now does this whole, The Way of the Master, Todd?
He likes to work with and partner with Ray Comfort, also known as Banana Man. Ray Comfort is the one, I believe, who rewrote the introduction to your great-great-grandfather's book, The Origin of Species. And I guess, didn't rewrite it. He just wrote a completely new one that is apparently scientifically flawed and completely misleading. And then they distribute this like it's the Origin of Species. But the whole intro is like debunking the book or attempting to debunk it.
Yeah. I've seen this. Well, I hope I get the chance. I'm very ready for some head-to-head aggressive debating here. It'll be a pleasure.
So, Matthew, has the film been released anywhere besides the US yet?
I don't know. It's been sold to the UK. It's been sold to Indonesia, China, Middle East, India, all of South America, Canada. I mean, it's going to get seen by an enormous number of people, which is great.
That's excellent.
Yeah, it did very well. It opened in Russia sort of simultaneously with America for some reason and did very well theatrically there. And so I'm hopeful it'll get the same response elsewhere.
It'd be interesting to see if the reviews and kind of general support are very different in more secular countries than they might be from America.
Yeah, I think it'll be very different. And I think that some of it, unfortunately, will be kind of, well, you know, those Americans are just crazy and nuts. And, you know, we don't have that problem. And I hope that some of it will be, sympathetic and intrigued, because there's no saying in what direction things go. You know, if you look at Holland, for example, and the number of Muslims who now live in cities like Amsterdam and the kinds of things that have happened there, or in Germany also, and in England, you know, fundamentalist religion is something that should be taken seriously. And it's true that my film is specific to America in the sense that you have a sort of fundamentalist Christian, but the argument that exists between the fundamentalist Christian and the atheist could just as well be an argument between an atheist and a Muslim. You know, so
right.
I hope people will see that.
Did you think about at all the concept of maybe putting any famous atheists into the movie in cameo positions? I'm envisioning like a scene where, I don't know, Richard Dawkins plays a bellboy in the hotel or something like that.
You know, that is a fabulous idea. And I didn't think of it. And I wish I had. That's a brilliant, brilliant idea. And I shall take credit for it next time I make a movie. You know, there's a famous line between, I think, Frank Harris and Oscar Wilde, where Frank Harris made some sort of brilliant remark, and Oscar Wilde said, "Oh, I wish I'd made that remark. I wish I'd said that. I wish I could take credit for it." And Frank Harris said, "You will." So, you know, that is a brilliant idea. It'd be nice to you. Do you remember Annie Hall?
Yes.
And you remember how at one point they're standing in a movie, they're going to the movies and they're standing in line and someone is rabbiting on about Marshall McLuhan. And Woody Allen steps out of line and says, "Well, this is Marshall McLuhan here. He's a friend of mine." And actually, he doesn't think that at all. And Marshall McLuhan appears out of line and says, "This is nonsense what you're saying. This has nothing to do with my ideas." And so it'd be great to have that a situation like that where you had Dawkins sort of standing in a movie line and giving his opinion.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would.
If you were going to launch another movie with very strong atheistic themes and attempt to get humanists and atheists out to the theaters, what would you do differently next time around?
Well, I don't know if I'd even try it next time. I think maybe a better strategy would just be to bring the movie out as a movie and let it find its audience, because I mean, it has not been easy releasing The Ledge, and there's a large part of me that would like to do some more trivial stuff, and probably will have to make money, but my heart is in this, and it's what I find most interesting in life, is how people believe things that cause so many problems and for which there's so little evidence.
Do you consider yourself a filmmaker first or an activist first?
That's a good question. I think I'm drifting. You know, I would definitely have said I was a filmmaker first 10 years ago. But with things like Science Debate and The Ledge and, you know, issues I've been involved in the last few years, it's really hard to divide the two. You know, the film is the voice that I speak with, but the brain is still directing the voice, you know.
So, Matthew, I'm just curious, have you thought about doing a film about your great-great-grandfather? And for those of our listeners who don't know, that's Charles Darwin.
Yeah, and I've been asked once or twice to try something like that. And it's very difficult because, you know, his life up to and through the Beagle was kind of quite interesting, but very expensive. You know, it involves boats going around the world and so on. His life after the Beagle was very internal in a way. I mean, he was just sort of doing research and, you know, thinking, which is not particularly dramatic. And I think this, the film Creation, which was based on a book, I believe, that was based on a box of items belonging to his daughter, Annie, who died, I thought was pretty good. I thought it got a little bit weird at the end when the sort of daughter appears like as a ghost figure, but I thought that was a pretty good movie. Did you see it?
I saw part of it on an airplane. It looked really depressing.
Yeah, yeah. It is very sad. I mean, it's about the inexplicable death of his daughter. Inexplicable to him in a sort of theological sense, and how it sort of pushes him a little bit closer towards atheism as it pushes his wife a little bit closer to God. You know, I suppose that in a way is reflected in The Ledge, where you have two characters who've suffered a lot, and one of them has reacted to his suffering by becoming more involved in God, and the other one has reacted by becoming less involved with God.
All right, so Matthew Chapman, what's next for you?
The next thing I'm going to do is a movie set in 15th century Florence under the a time in Florence when you had the Medicis, the bankers, were financing the arts and all of that stuff. But you also had a very gruesome Dominican friar called Savonarola, who was burning art and had these things called the Bonfires of the Vanities, which was, we'd burn art and poetry and pretty clothes and books and anything that he deemed even remotely erotic or lewd. So it was, you know, it's set in that period, and it's like The Ledge, it has a sort of a slightly subversive quality in that on one level, it's just a simple teen romance set in the 15th century. On another level, it's dealing with these bigger issues of, you know, religion.
Tell us about, this is switching gears a lot, but you mentioned this earlier, and I want to know more about Science Debate, but specifically for 2012 and what you have in mind and what's rolling there. And I guess maybe inform our listeners a little bit about what Science Debate is.
Well, Science Debate was an idea that that I had, and then I founded this organization. I'm still the president of it, but I had these amazing co-founders, Sean Otto, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, Lawrence Krauss, the physicist, Darlene Cavalier, who is a sort of science advocate and a Republican, and Austin Dacey, who was a philosopher who's no longer involved, and Chris Mooney, who's a science writer and advocate. And the idea was we would try and pull the scientific community together to put enough pressure on the presidential candidates that they would have a debate devoted solely to science and technology rather than just the old faith and values stuff. And by the time we'd, you know, put together 40,000 leading scientists, academicians, politicians, business people. I mean, it was an incredible, we had 20 Nobel laureates. We had 120 universities pushing for this, and we almost got the candidates to have a debate. Very towards the end, we had Obama, Clinton, and McCain at that point. and Clinton dropped out, and we had Obama and McCain sort of agreeing to a debate at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and we had Nova and now PBS shows as our broadcast partner. And at the last minute, they went and did a faith and values debate at Messiah College. So we failed, but we got them to answer 14 questions on science, which we'd synthesized from our membership. And when we published their responses to these questions, we made 850 million media impressions around the world.
That's astounding.
Yeah, it was fantastic. But the remaining debates, and there were about another 10 debates after this, none of them took advantage of the questions that we had forced the candidates to answer. Nobody pushed further to find out how serious they were about stem cell research, how serious they were about climate change or ocean health. It was terrible to us. It was terrible to me personally that debate didn't happen. Well, now we're gearing up again, and we're about to start back to work on it. And now we have our 40,000 supporters, our signatories, our allies, and we're starting about the same time, but with all of this going for us. I mean, it's kind of bizarre, really, when you think about it, on every level, that such a debate does not exist. I mean, why wouldn't you have a debate about the issues that will actually determine the future of our children?
Especially considering that they, instead of doing this, apparently did one on faith and values. I totally understand having a debate on values, because I do think that is important for candidates. But faith is specifically barred as a criteria for election as an elected official, to speak redundantly, in the Constitution, in Article 6. Now, that doesn't mean you can't talk about it and try to convince people that it should be a criteria, but I think it's kind of a sad state of affairs when you've got candidates that want to profess their faith rather than profess what they're going to do about real life issues.
Yeah, it's sad and ridiculous, because, you ask them, do you have faith? And they'll go, yes. And that's the end of the conversation. I mean, it was interesting, actually, that in the debate that they went to instead of coming to ours, just by chance, there were some people in the audience, Christians, who were asking scientific questions. I don't know if it was because they had heard that our debate had been cancelled in favor of theirs and they were doing the decent thing or what. But, I mean, there are many very big ethical questions involved in science, to do with, stem cell research, but, I mean, also to do with, how healthy the water is in Africa and how much money we should give to scientific and medical efforts that will solve problems in the third world or the developing world, as opposed to spending, there's many, many big ethical issues to be discussed in the context of science and technology. And, it's a fascinating debate. When it happens, it'll be very interesting, I think.
So on the show, we've often talked about, there's this concept of new atheism and new humanism. And new humanism, some folks have the idea that let's not focus on the things that we don't agree on, but instead let's try to come together and make the world a better place with as far as the things that we do agree on goes. And I think with these science debates, you're providing an opportunity to do that, because it doesn't matter what you believe in as far as an afterlife or not. One thing that we can all agree on is that we have this time that's guaranteed to us on Earth. We don't know how long that is. And this is the only human habitat that we know of. So we might as well work together to make that the most sustainable and the cleanest and the healthiest environment that we have.
Yeah, and there are Christian organizations and other faiths that have big sort of ecological save the earth kind of movements. So yeah, there's a lot. I think we have a lot in common there.
Did you try to involve physicians and teachers?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, we had. We had Harold Varmus, for example, who's, I think he's head of Memorial Sloan Kettering now, cancer. Mm-hmm. No, we had all kinds of people. And then we had 125 university presidents had signed on, you know, from Harvard, Stanford, you know, if you look at the list, it's the cream of the academic crop.
But why should we listen to them? What do they know?
Well, they know, yeah.
Nice, Todd. So, Matthew, thank you so much for speaking with the Humanist Hour, and good luck with your future projects, the science debate, and your new movie that is soon to be named. I can't wait to see it.
Jess and Todd, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Matthew. Have a great one.
That was writer, director, and producer Matthew Chapman talking about his movie, The Ledge. You can learn more about The Ledge at ledgemovie.com. Remember, it's not too late to help the success of The Ledge. You can still download and view the movie on Sundance as well as iTunes. So find links to that on our show notes page at thehumanisthour.org.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend the movie. And anybody who's listened to this, I think there's a very good chance you'll enjoy it. I know I did. So, Jess, I believe we have a listener call-in.
Indeed, we did, Todd, from Dallas, Pennsylvania, actually, which means it's time to play Google Garble. So, Todd, why don't you go ahead and read the translation of the voicemail, and then we'll listen to it after that.
Hi, Jess inside. I'm just giving you a call. I hope that Google does not negle this message. This is It Was Mongos and Yeah, It LGT Pride Podcast. But I just wanted to give you guys a great big sums up in the show. I'm very excited for you. List the project anyone comes out on the big fan from Dallas, Pennsylvania. My name's Casey, either way, and I just want to thank you so much for what you're doing. This is a terrific job. I usually download You're My Car, and I'm driving my way to work. And it's a nice, refreshing change from usual talk radio, which is but disabled. 5415, and I'll be out there on the So Guys. Great job, and pick up the great work. Take it easy.
Todd, pick up the great work, would you?
I will try to pick it up.
Yeah, get on that, Todd. Okay, so let's hear the actual voicemail.
Hi, Jess and Todd. I'm just giving you a call. I hope that Google does not mangle this message as much as it was mangled in LGBT Pride podcast, but I just wanted to give you guys a great big thumbs up on the show. I'm very excited to listen to the podcast when a new one comes out. I'm a big fan from Dallas, Pennsylvania. My name is Casey, by the way, and I just wanted to try to keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a terrific job. I usually download you in my car as I'm driving my way to work, and it's a nice refreshing change from usual talk radio, which is, let's just say, a little biased toward one side and not the other. So guys, great job and keep up the great work. Take it easy.
So Casey, thank you so much for calling. Thank you for listening. And, if you're on your way to work, I was just wondering whose car you took so I would know what to expect when I walked out my door. If it was your car or my car, I wasn't sure.
I think it was your my car. That.
Your my car.
Yes.
Right, right. Anyway, don't be late to work. Don't text and drive, and have an awesome day. So if you would like to hear how Google garbles your voicemail to us, I highly recommend it. I think you'll find it's entertaining. Please give us a call at 202-618-1371. If you don't have a pen handy, because like Casey, you're driving to work while you listen to this, you can always visit our website, which is thehumanisthour.org. And from there, you can listen to and read about previous episodes. You can always comment there if you'd prefer to do that. And you can like us on Facebook, Todd. We reached our goal. Last month, we said we wanted to get 100 likes so that we could have one of those fancy pants vanity URLs on Facebook. And we did it.
Awesome.
So we are at facebook.com/thehumanisthour.
And for the weeks that we are not on the air, since this is a monthly show, you can check out the weekly e-zine of the American Humanist Association by going to AmericanHumanist.org/HNN.
Thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Jess Constantine.
And I'm Todd Stiefel. Have a great summer, folks.